And we are back. Phil Williams, Right Side Radio, covering all of North Alabama. Solid conservative, just plain right. And, oh, by the way, saving the world one soundbite at a time. Hey, listen, I felt like it was time to lighten things up. And when I say that, I don't mean like there's nothing serious about what we're going to talk about next. I just meant that it's every once in a while you got to stop. You got to get away from the Mar-a-Lago raid. You got to get away from the taxes and the IRS agents being boosted, all that stuff. Stuff that drives us crazy and probably brings in a lot of phone calls. But nonetheless, what I really wanted to do, too, was take some time and say, you know what? We live in Alabama. Who's cool that lives here that does things that matter? And one of those is somebody who's been calling into the show, for months now. And that's Allie Turner. And Allie is here. And you guys may have heard it's Allie from Athens. All right? So when we get the call and it's Allie from Athens, I usually go, hey, it's Allie. Then I take the phone call. But Allie from Athens is in the studio. Allie, how are you doing?
I am doing well. I am honored to be here, and I have been looking forward to this. I'm actually just home from my mom's memorial service.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But she did not die just recently. She died in 2020, but because of COVID craziness, it wasn't until now that we could join together. So I've been in Illinois, and it was a wonderful service, and came home, and here I am.
Well, I'm sorry, but I'm also glad you were able to finally gather with family.
Thank you. Well, she was 100 years old, sir.
Wow.
Yeah, so it wasn't like she cut out early.
Are you going to call me sir the whole time we're doing this?
Probably. And I'll tell you why. I mean, I'm originally from the left coast, right?
Yeah.
And on the left coast, when you say ma'am or sir, it's not a signification of respect. It's distancing and it's patronizing. So one of the first things...
What is happening right now?
I know. But, and so when we first moved here, which we came from Mexico, from the mission field in Ciudad Juarez, right across from Bliss, 22 years ago, almost to the day, I had to really work to get my ma'ams and sirs down. So what I'm asking you respectfully, sir, is please don't make me stop saying sir.
So you're saying it's not patronizing and demeaning.
Exactly.
Gotcha. All right. Well, listen, Allie, you've got an incredible story. So which camera am I on right now, Boomer? I'm looking on this one. So I've got her book, Ballad for Baghdad. So the Ballad for Baghdad, and the subtitle is An Ex-Hippie Chick's Ex-hippie chick, Vietnam War protesters, 3 years in Iraq. Mm-hmm. You've got a pretty cool personal story. So before I even get to the book, so you lived on the left coast, missionary in Mexico, I believe. Mm-hmm. Ciudad Juarez, you said. Mm-hmm. I know that you live here in Alabama now, but you've had a roundabout journey getting here to the great state of Alabama. So give us a moment here. How is it that you were a Vietnam War protester, and what was your life like back in the day?
Well, let's just say that if you and I had met 50 years ago, I would have considered you to be a baby killer.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. And if I had had the opportunity to spit on you in Oakland Airport, I would have. That's where I was.
Well, my dad faced that. Somebody spit on my dad in the airport when he came back from his second tour in Vietnam.
Yeah. And you can imagine what it must have been like for my father, who was a World War II Naval Air Corps vet who served in the Pacific, to watch all three of us just go crazy. I mean, it was the craziness. You think we have craziness now, and we do, but the thing that I love to tell people is, hang on, it got crazy, but then God moved.
Yeah.
And we're going to see, we are starting to see it, we're going to see it again. So in the midst of all of that was when I got saved. I became a born-again believer in the Jesus People movement.
Yeah.
And so that was the turning point. But I think it's important to understand that because my focus was so much on the ministry at the time, that there were a lot of things that were just still kind of percolating around in the back of my mind that I didn't even know needed to be challenged until I married Steve Turner, who was a Minnesota farm boy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you got the Midwest dose at that point.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he was Baptist. He got saved when he was 7 years old. You know, he had not bought into the kinds of things in the 70s, 60s, and 70s that I did. And so he would say, to his credit, when we would talk about things, I mean, I was basically there, but there were particularly things that had to do with business.
Yeah.
I still was of the belief that all business was, you know, second-class citizen, you know, anybody in business was materialistic. So those were the things that he would say, okay, I see this and this, but what about this? And I would just kind of go, kong, like Donald Duck.
Well, so back in the day, so your dad's a World War II vet. You mm-hmm. grew up in a, you know, from what I read in the book, you grew up in a pretty solid home.
Yes, sir.
You were one of three siblings, I mm-hmm. think you said, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I have two older sisters.
And then you went off to, what college was it you went to?
I went to Oberlin.
Yeah, Oberlin College, mm-hmm. Not far from Kent State.
Correct.
And a lot of social upheaval at the time.
Yes.
And am I correct that was at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base you actually went and protested outside the gate trying to get them to shut the gates down?
Yeah, yeah. Talk about hubris. Oh, my word.
We're going to shut the whole place down.
That's right. That's exactly right. We were going to shut the whole place down, and it was that and trying to shut down the Cleveland County Courthouse in protest to the mining of Hanoi Harbor in April of 72.
And on one of those, you made the news.
That was the Cleveland County Courthouse one. Yeah.
Okay, did you make the news because, like, they actually talked to you, or are you just in the crowd? Really?
Yes, they actually talk. I know, it's so embarrassing, but...
I mean it's live. It's a different alley in a sense, mm-hmm. but it's also a part of the fabric of you. And here you are now.
Yes, exactly. And I don't think anybody loves Alabama more than I do.
Well, I'm glad.
Yeah, we can throw down over that, sir. But I mean, seriously, yeah.
So, okay. We'll arm wrestle over who loves Alabama more, me or you. But so the thing I forgot to mention though is you do live here now. And you are the, am I correct saying you are the chief editor and publisher of Athens Now?
We actually own the newspaper.
Okay.
Steve and I own the newspaper. All right. I started writing for them. Well, when I came home from Iraq, I took a year to write the book.
All right.
And then I took a year to market the book. And at the tail end of that season, Athens Now, the founders who founded it 15 years ago, contacted me. And asked me to start writing for them. And then in 2011, we bought the paper.
Okay. All right. So that's where you are right now.
Yes, sir.
Late 60s, early 70s, you had Protest Alley going on.
Mm-hmm.
You met the Lord sometime in the early 70s during the Jesus Movement.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And then somewhere in between, you and Steve decided it would be a great idea to spend some time in Mexico, south of the border, doing mission work, and you were there for 2 or 3 years, weren't you?
2 years.
2 years.
Yes, and see, Steve and I are second marriage.
Okay.
And so we married in 1995, and then we went on a three-week mission trip in 1997
mm-hmm.
and knew that we were being called there. We knew that it wasn't necessarily going to be forever, but we knew that we were going to be being called there, and so we were there from 98 to 2000.
All right. Well, listen, we're up against the heartbreak. We're going to take it right now. When we get back, though, we're going to start developing this storyline because she went from Mexico back to Alabama to Baghdad. All right, folks. Phil Williams, Right Side Radio, in the studio right now with Allie Turner, the author of Ballad for Baghdad, the owner of Athens Now. We'll find out more about her story when we get back. Phil Williams, Right Side Radio. All right, we are back. Phil Williams, Right Side Radio. We are spanning from south of Birmingham to north of Huntsville, Tuscaloosa, over to Gadsden, covering the northern half of the great state of Alabama. Solid conservative and just plain right. So I am in studio right now with my, what has been my phone friend, but is now my friend in real life, Allie Turner, the owner of Athens Now, which, by the way, y'all publish every first and third Friday, right?
Yes, sir.
So twice a month.
Mm-hmm.
Allie, you wrote this book, and I'm holding up to the camera again. How am I holding this up? Bam. That one. Boomer has to tell me which camera. Ballad for Baghdad. And before we go too far down the line, and I want to forget, how can folks get a copy? I ordered mine on Amazon.
Amazon's the easiest.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. I ordered mine on Amazon. It's Allie Turner, A Ballad for Baghdad is the book. I found it very easily. Got it delivered right to the house. A couple of stories, I mean, that came out of the book. the bulk of the book, obviously, is your time overseas mm-hmm. in Baghdad. 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
Allie, I was there for like 10 and a half months, and that was a long time. 3 years. So let's talk about this. You, first of all, just to get some of the jargon out of the way, you worked in MWR, which, you know, as a troop guy, I can just tell you MWR means the world because that's morale, welfare, and recreation.
That's right.
That's basically where the troops can go put their feet up, maybe get something cold to drink, find a paperback book, and
watch
hang
a movie,
out.
Watch a movie. Play ping pong, shoot pool.
Yeah.
And I want you to know that I made a real point of always wearing bright colored. I almost always wore a Hawaiian shirt with long khaki pants because we had to, and our shoes had to be steel-toed. But once I got inside of Saddam or Uday's building, I would take my shoes off and have bright matching socks because I wanted to just provide as much of a touch of home as I possibly could.
Well, that's true. When it's amazing. I remember one of the things that struck me when I came home, especially from my first tour in Afghanistan, was the amount of color. I mean, I came from a world of grays and browns and mm-hmm. muted colors to all of a sudden, like, boom, I'm in the West and there's this color everywhere, especially green, because we didn't have a whole lot of green where I was at. But anyway, so you worked MWR, but talk about how this happened. I mean, what was it that, and I remember reading the story here, and I've got it on page 16 of your book. A guy named Danny Lambert actually had to intervene and say, would you please find this woman a job in Iraq?
Yes.
But how
did that happen?
Yeah.
Okay. My brother-in-law, Chuck, was actually, he was an advisor to Bremen.
Okay.
And Bremer, excuse me, and General Sanchez. He was in the CPA Palace.
Yeah.
The Coalition Provisional Authority. Mm-hmm. And he did IT and other kinds of things. And this is like the dinosaur days of chats. And the Ministry of Oil had been bombed. He happened to get on the chat to let people know that he was okay. And that we had kind of like this spontaneous family reunion. And as we were talking, chatting, and Steve, my husband Steve is an over-the-road truck driver.
Right.
So I had the phone crooked.
Big yellow truck named Sunshine.
Yeah.
That's exactly. Go ahead.
Right. It's almost on its last leg. It's got like 1.5 million miles on it. Anyway, I had Steve crooked in my shoulder. I was reading their responses, typing in his responses, typing in my own responses, and out of nowhere, almost like a little ticker tape, Chuck put in, "If anybody is looking for a job, there are jobs available."
Okay. In Baghdad.
In Baghdad. Yeah. And honestly, as God is my witness, and I'm not saying that rhetorically, in my mind, I felt like the Holy Spirit said, I need to do this.
Oh,
and
wow.
At the exact same time, Steve said into my ear, hun, you need to do this.
That's no small thing.
No.
I mean, this is not like, I need to be the brownie troop leader. This is not like, yeah. I'm going to lead a church small group right here in my hometown.
Yeah, exactly.
This is, I'm going to the war zone as a civilian mm-hmm. with no military training. Oh, mm-hmm. by the way, I used to be a war protester.
Yeah.
And I'm going to hang out with troops for 3 years.
Yes. And so what ended up happening was I applied and I was hired and then I fell through the cracks. And there, I mean, it was
like several months, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
And so what ended up happening was Steve and I had been talking and praying about it. And, you know, his take on it was, well, maybe all that was supposed to happen was that you were supposed to be willing to go.
Yeah.
And if that was the case, I passed the test and that was that. So he said, try. And I worked for Kellogg Brown and Root, and they were the Department of Defense contractor that handled MWR. And so for a very brief amount of time, they had a hotline that was posted on the internet. Very brief.
Yeah.
And so I called the hotline, and it
bumped you.
It did. It bumped me to these execs. And there was a fellow by the name of Mr. Austin. And I said, Mr. Austin, you don't know me. My name is Allie Turner. And I just told him what the situation is. Would you please be able to get my contact info to whoever would be in charge?
So
they had Danny Lambert call me. Danny Lambert actually had a sister who lived in Huntsville, and he was the one who
Okay,
got
so
to them. So this that's is how that
this
happened.
Is the equivalent of. Of I called customer service and I got the VP of the company.
Yeah, almost.
All right. And then Danny Lambert eventually said what I quoted a while ago, after sort of checking around and still not finding resolution, he finally said, would someone please get this woman a job?
Yeah.
All right. So I read the part about how you packed up your two, and by the way, we called them team boxes, but they were your big black foot lockers, mm-hmm. right? You got these things, you loaded up, you said goodbye to your family, and you had yourself a moment getting on the plane.
I did.
Where I read, and I get it, but you literally got on the plane and you thought, what have I done?
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to Baghdad. Mm-hmm. Because, oh, by the way, not only your husband, but you've got kids back home. Not, mm-hmm. Now, they weren't school-age kids anymore, but nonetheless, right. You got a family.
Yes. Yes. But right. It was one of those things. We just knew that I was supposed to go in the same way that we knew that we were supposed to go and live in the middle of the cartel at an orphanage and start a school.
Yeah.
And so
this was a call.
What has got me ready for Baghdad? In fact, when I got there and I was able to get to a phone booth, the plywood ones, you know
yeah,
what
oh
I'm
yeah.
talking about?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Get to a phone booth and call Steve and let him know that I had arrived. I said, honey, it is just like what is. It smells the same. It looks the same. It's just a different language base.
Yeah.
So I did not have a lot of the same adjustment. And I mean, there was the combat piece, obviously. You know, we were living with neighbors who would prefer to store our heads in a refrigerator. But, you know, other than that, I already felt like I had done some advanced work, advanced training before I got there.
Well, you know, one of the things I love about your book is how you personalize the number of people who were impactful or were French, you know, a friend to you at the time, or for that matter, lives that you felt like you were able to touch while you were there. But one of the things that first strikes me, and you kind of allude to this, not allude to it, you say it, in the subtitle of the book, An Ex-Hippie Chick Vietnam War Protester's 3 Years in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
So let me ask you this. In the early days, they were baby killers. But then you went over there and served.
I went over to say I'm sorry.
Mm.
And I went over to say thank you. That's why I went. That was the calling. And you know what, really, Phil, when I went, I had no idea. First of all, it was bizarre to me that I actually got the security clearance that I did and that I ended up on Robin Air.
They didn't look at your life and go, oh, Lord.
Yes, indeed. And so I truly did not know what to expect. I mean, I'd never lived in a combat zone before. And I really expected soldiers to be focused and kind of aloof.
Yeah.
And I was just going to adjust to that. I never expected to be so dearly loved. And that was what happened, was that I had already come away from all the 60s craziness and the, you know, the Marxist craziness and all that kind of stuff. But I did not expect to be so forgiven. Mm. And that was the thing that meant so much to me. Was,
did you tell them your story?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And let me give you... Let me
did
give
they freak
you...
out? Hang on. What do we got here? How are we doing on time, Boomer? Are we good? Yeah, we're good. Go ahead.
Okay. Yes, I would tell them my story. And I would invariably get these looks of, wow, that's so cool. Thank you for coming over
that
here.
That sounds like Joe.
Yeah.
Joe and Jane.
Yes.
They would find that to be cool. But, you know, I think it's cool. And the reality is this. It is cool, but it's also very redemptive. But then at the same time, I got to look at it and go, you didn't sign up for 3 years. You signed up for one, but you stayed for three. So,
yes.
So tell me, how did you wind up getting to the point that you said, I'm not going home yet? Oh, by the way, honey, I'm not coming home yet. How did that go?
That happened, 22nd SIG, there are pictures of them.
Yeah.
I had the privilege of leading worship with several groups that rotated in. And I loved all of them. But 22nd SIG, they were just special.
Hmm.
And our worship leader asked me to stay.
Hmm.
And I called Steve and... He started crying, but he said, I know it's God. You got to do it, hon. And so I did.
So he kept on eating ramen noodles and peanut butter, and you stay for another year,
yeah.
2 years.
Yeah, well, I'm eating steak in the defect.
I'm telling you right now, I will say this. You worked for KBR,
uh-huh.
Kellogg Brown and Root.
Yeah.
And you know, for all the dissing that some, you know, defense contractors get, we had the FOB that I was on was a little small FOB out in central Baghdad, not far from where Saddam statue was torn down. And we had a DFAC, a dining facility, that was basically two big double-wide trailers put together.
Yes, that's how
and
it was.
And KBR fed us well.
Oh, yeah, they did.
I mean, they fed us well.
And I'm telling you, one of the best parts was because most of the third country nationals that did food service were from India.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, we had a Philippine crew in ours.
Yes.
And they.
But when you got to have native food every day, oh, my word, I got so spoiled. I did. You know.
I remember thinking when I got there, because I had lived among the Afghan people during my Afghanistan rotation, eating all Afghan food, got dysentery 5 times, lost 30 pounds. I thought, by golly, I'm not anything local. Ain't nothing local going to cross these lips. And then I got there and I realized I had a KBR mess hall and I thought, God is so good.
Yes, he is.
All right, listen, Allie, we got to take a break.
Okay.
We're going to come right back and keep this conversation going. I hope you guys are enjoying this because this is legit. I mean, as a veteran of both Afghanistan and Iraq, I can just tell you how much I appreciate the number of people who went over there that didn't have to. There were no orders. There was no piece of paper that said you are hereby commanded. This was just a calling. And I can just tell you, as having had an MWR facility that I would go in and out of occasionally, it means something. So Allie, thank you, and we'll talk more when we get back. Phil
thank
Williams,
you.
Right Side Radio. Solid, conservative, and just plain right. We'll be right back. All right, Phil Williams, we are back. Hey, listen, it's not often that I sit here during a break swapping war stories with a hippie war protester.
That's it.
But we have been in some of the same places at roughly the same time. You said that you were actually there. We had Ted Nugent on the show last week, and you were actually there.
Bleep, bleep, bleep.
Yes,
bleep,
exactly.
Bleep. Yeah. Nice work, Booms.
We're not going to have to bleep you out today, I don't think.
No.
All right. You were just telling me that you drove one of Uday Hussein's cars.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, what was it?
Well, it wasn't like I was just cruising around Baghdad in it. I got to drive it once. See, one of the things that people don't realize, when the French and the Germans were oh so protesting about our oh so imperialistic involvement.
Oh yeah.
The reason is because they never followed the sanctions. And so during the years, Uday needed, I mean, everyone needs 1,200 cars. And so Rabunia was his place, and there were any number of Beamers and Renaults. And so there was a 5-speed Beamer that, you know how some of the tougher contractors would just sort of, they would sort of appropriate for a while they were there. Okay, so this guy, I don't know if he was human intelligence. I don't remember what the guy did, and he was also
he was a spook.
Blacksmith. Yeah. Well, he let me drive it one time. And so, yes, I took it out and took it out to see what it could do on the straightaway between Rodwinia and down Indian country.
So one souvenir I almost got, because I like unusual souvenirs.
Mm-hmm.
One souvenir I almost got, but it just didn't work out, was there was a abandoned Ferrari on the backside of our fob. That was apparently one of Uday's Ferraris.
Yeah,
and we're across the Tigris from you, across from the Green Zone, about an hour from Camp Victory where you were. But I tried to get one of the valve covers off the engine because you know that says.
What, you were just going to settle for the valve cover and not try and get the whole thing to come home?
I couldn't pack that in my ruck. But well, listen, Allie, back to what we're doing here. So you were there on a mission. You had a calling to be there. You stayed there for 3 whole years. You wrote a great book.
Thank you.
And it's so full of stories. And I did show her, by the way, that even though I'm not finished reading it yet, I've got highlights and folded down dog-eared pages all through it. I don't even know where to begin. But you had some interesting stories here. Like, for instance, you said that you were actually pretty close to Saddam several times, but one of the guys...
Wait, how do we define close, sir?
Okay, you weren't buddies with Saddam. You saw him go by. Let's put it that way.
Yes.
All right. You mean?
Well, there were when Saddam and his name was Melvin. Do you know why?
Saddam's name was Melvin?
Yes, Saddam's name was Melvin on the radio because that stood for Melvin Victor, which stood for most valued detainee. So, if Melvin was on the move, you had to stop where you were because it was very important that you not make eye contact with the carrier. it was a PSYOPs thing, I think, psychological thing. Because Saddam was incredibly intimidating.
He was also manipulative.
Very. Yeah. I mean, he was a true sociopath. And he was tall. A lot of Iraqis are not. Saddam was tall and very imposing. He spoke like five languages, including Russian. Mm. He was a force to be reckoned with. And so we were not to look up when we knew that he was going
by.
Not
that you were kowtowing, you just weren't engaging him.
Yeah, you were not to engage. There was to be no contact that way. And then on Cropper, where he was actually being held before he went to trial, they had a teeny tent. The Cropper tent DFAC had food brought in from other FOBs, and it wasn't a whole lot bigger than this room in which we find ourselves. And they put a tarp tunnel so that when he came in and out, there was no contact with him. So
I had a friend of mine that actually helped run the detention facility where he was mm-hmm. at, and he mm-hmm. said that one of the crazy little nuances was Saddam was real fond of Cheetos.
Oh, yeah. In fact, he ate so many Cheetos before he was hanged. Okay, do you remember the whole thing about the hunger strike?
Yeah.
The hunger strike was because he wanted to be looking good for the execution. And so he fasted and selected his execution outfit because he didn't want to go into the next life with a paunch.
Because they ate so many Cheetos.
Yeah, and Fruit Loops. Yes,
well,
sir.
One of the things you talk about engaging Saddam, so he had a very cool story in chapter 14 of your book about a guy you refer to as Mr. X. And Mr. X had been a sniper at one point and who literally during the first Gulf War mm-hmm. at one point says that he actually had Saddam in his crosshairs, but he could not get clearance to take the shot.
He asked three times to take the shot.
But that later on, he wound up being some form of a technician in the jail, working the HVAC mm-hmm. as a contractor, I guess.
Yes.
And that Mr. X wound up being in the cell with Saddam and went ahead and just engaged for a moment and just kind of made sure he knew that he was wearing that his parents had, or grandparents had immigrated from Israel mm-hmm. and that he was wearing a Star of David. Mm-hmm. And it didn't sit well with Saddam.
That's exactly right. But here is the great grace of God. Even Saddam Hussein had the opportunity to hear the gospel. Mm-hmm. And I let that sink in. And this is how it happened. Mr. X, who hadn't been able to take the shot, was called in because Saddam's air conditioning had gone on the blink. We might have to, this is a story, so we might have to tell part of it and then come back.
We might, because we got about a minute left now for this break.
Okay, so I will get this part in. People need to understand that to Saddam, having air conditioning was incredibly important. And so when the air conditioner went out, that was a national emergency, and it needed to be taken care of right away. And so Mr. X came in to what had been the fishing lodge one night when we were doing practice for praise and worship, and his eyes were as big as saucers. And he said, "You guys, you're not going to believe what happened." And so
that's
the story.
Because I did read this story. And it's crazy cool.
It is crazy cool.
So we're going to talk about it with Alec Turner when we get back. She's the author of Ballad for Baghdad, my friend from Athens, who spent 3 years volunteering to serve the troops in Iraq after having been a war protester during Vietnam. Very cool personal story. Phil Williams, Right Side Radio. We got more. Y'all stay tuned.
Right Side Radio with Phil Williams. It's hard to go wrong when you're on the right side. Right Side Radio. Solid, conservative, and just plain right.
Alabama syndicated news talk leader, Right Side Radio. Phil Williams here live in the Right Side Studios. Solid conservative, just plain right, man. We are covering down on the issues, and we're spending time. We're gonna spend a little more time now with my friend, Allie Turner. We were phone friends. We're real friends. Allie, I appreciate you. Thank you for driving over here, by the way. Athens is a bit of a haul. You drove over just to...
It was worth it. Absolutely.
Yeah, well, it's worth it to me. I know that. So we were in the middle of a story you were talking about. So Mr. X,
a former sniper,
once had Saddam in his crosshairs during the first Gulf War, couldn't get permission to pull the trigger, and years later he's face to face with the target.
Yes, and this is what's important to understand. Saddam, there were things that Saddam absolutely had to have. One was air conditioning in the desert, and there on the as well, there were things that Saddam felt did not have the right to exist. One was Persians, one was flies, and one was Jews.
Flies. Okay.
Yeah.
Didn't see flies. That coming, but okay.
Yeah, and you never knew when, in all of the 57 palaces, you never knew whether he would show up at 5 for dinner at your particular palace. So there were meals made every single night in all of the palaces. Okay. So Mr. X comes into what had been the fishing lodge. The assault phase chaplain got the fishing lodge to fish for the souls of men.
Ah.
And he played percussion. He was a wonderful, wonderful brother. And he came in one night with his eyes as big as saucers and said, "You guys, you're not going to believe what happened." So this is why I needed to tell the story about the air conditioning. Because if Saddam was going without air conditioning, you know, the world was going to go off of its axis.
Prisoner number one's having problems,
yes,
so we got to fix it.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
And so he had been called in to fix Saddam's air conditioning. And he had to sign...
Mr. X did.
And but he didn't know, because see, on our camp... were the top 7 of the deck of 52.
Yeah.
And so for that, what that means is...
I still got my deck.
Do you?
Yeah, I do.
I never got one. But the deck of 52, for those that don't know what that is, it's a deck of playing cards that had the pictures of the 52 most important people so that people would be able to have visual recognition. Well, we have the top 7. So we figured it would be someone from the top 7, but he did not expect it to be Saddam. So he is down on the right-hand side of this rather wieldy air conditioning machine, and he's tinkering away, and in comes Saddam with loin chains and his nose put up against the wall. And you weren't supposed to speak to him.
So Saddam's put in the timeout position over against the wall.
Yeah.
And
he looks over at Mr. X, and the fellow that was his guard did not speak Spanish. So Saddam looked at Mr. X, who was Hispanic, and started to speak to him in Spanish. And so Mr. X kind of thought, okay, well, it's on now. And the first question that he asked Mr. X was, "Do you hate me?" And Mr. X said, "No." And he said, "Are you a Christian?" And he said, "Yes." Because, see, Saddam surrounded himself with Christians as far as tasters and bodyguards and maids and stuff because he felt safe. Strange.
And that it's odd.
Yeah, it is odd. And so he said, "Are you Catholic?" "No." "Are you Baptist?" "No." He said, "What are you?" He said, "I am Baptist." That's what Mr. X said.
Yeah.
And so Saddam looked at him and said, "What's that?" And he said, "I believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God and died for our sins and rose on the third day." Looked him in the eye and gave him the gospel.
So the man who almost shot him some 10 years prior is now sharing the gospel with him in his own cell.
Exactly. And so Saddam sort of figuratively spat, and Mr. X thought, okay, it's on now. And what Saddam did not know was that it's wintertime, and so he had layered flannel shirts and stuff on. And Mr. X had a Star of David made by local folks, a very large Star of David, and he unbuttoned his shirt with his back to the guard and let the Star of David dangle. So now Saddam's in meltdown because something that appears to be Jewish is working on
his air conditioning.
Yeah. So, but he decided to pivot.
All you need now is Persians and flies, and
he's
got all of it
at one
time.
Yeah, and then we're good. There wouldn't have had to have been a hanging. He just would have died, you know. So what ended up happening was he went into that Arabic and how is your father and, you know, the discussions that you have about family. And the short story is that in Spanish, Mr. X told Saddam that his grandfather had emigrated from Israel, at which point Saddam started pounding his head on the wall. The guard jumped up, asked Mr. X what he had said to Saddam, and he looked at the guard and said, "Nothing. He was just asking me about my grandfather."
No kidding. That is hilarious.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've heard from my buddy who, like I said, ran the detention center, that Saddam was a very interesting character, like all these idiosyncrasies. But the idea that he stood there and began banging his head on the wall because there was a guy in his cell. Now, I guess Mr. X didn't tell him, by the way, I almost shot you 10 years ago.
I don't think they got to that
point.
Okay,
all right, yeah. But he did have the Star of David on. He did share the gospel with him. And oh, by the way, he did make it clear that he was wearing a Star of David.
Yes.
So
when he came in and told the story, I'm just saying praise and worship practice was over. We were draped across the pews. It was like the Boneless Chicken Ranch. We were just, it was done. We were howling.
That's a Far Side cartoon,
yes,
by the
indeed,
way.
Right. Yeah. We were done. We couldn't go any further. We were laughing too hard.
Well, listen, I got to ask you, and there's one more story we may have time for about the football game that occurred while you were in Baghdad. But let me ask you this. When you came home, I mean, did you find yourself wanting to stay for a fourth year? Because the troops were there for a good long time, and it was a rotating group of troops, and maybe the 22nd SIG was gone.
Mm-hmm.
Was it 3 years and you felt released to go home?
That's pretty much it.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I missed it terribly. I know you understand this. I miss it still. Mm. I mean, I how do you explain that to people that have never been in that kind of situation? But
there's a depth to the relationships you form because they form quicker.
Mm-hmm.
Something about being in that form of a crucible, and a shared cause. It creates a depth of relationship that happens a whole lot quicker than we seem to see in a daily life around home. And I don't know how to explain it except to say just that.
I agree. And when you meet people that were there,
yeah,
there is something that you just go straight to that depth, I would say.
Well, so, Allie, we got about 4 minutes left. So,
okay.
There's a story about a football game. And so give me the scoop on that
okay.
real quick. All right?
I'll do it real quick. All right. In my household, my grandfather served with Ike in World War I. He was Army. My father was Navy. There was no betting in our household except once a year. They bet a dollar in the Army-Navy game.
Okay.
So,
all right.
Yeah. So we had Delta, Rangers, and SEALs on Rodwania. We decided to have an Army-Navy football game on the same weekend of the Army-Navy football game.
Okay.
Okay. I had been coined by NCIS, and I got to toss the coin and tell them the story of my grandfather and my father, and to tell the story of having tried to shut down Wright Pat and the county courthouse, and tell them that I was sorry before we flipped and played the game. And they were so ticked because it was touch football. I mean, but, you know, they're running around having to play touch.
I guarantee it became street rules at some point.
Yes, yeah, lots of
it. But so you gave them your personal story.
Yeah, and then what happened was after the game was over, we went into Falcon Palace, which had been Uday's Palace,
yeah,
and an African-American Navy SEAL sat down across. We went through the line in the DFAC, got our food, went and sat down, and he looked at me and said, Allie, don't ever apologize again for having been a protester. It is your right to protest that we put our lives on the line to protect.
Mm, that's tough.
Yeah.
That's and by the way, that's a guy who got it.
Yeah. And that's the real deal. And either you get it or you don't. And that's really all you can say. He got it, and I have nothing but praise to God for my 3 years. It was, next to becoming a Christian, it was the most transformational thing I've ever experienced.
Well, I want to thank you again. I want to thank you, first of all, for driving over here. Thank you for writing the book so that I could catch a glimpse of what it was like. But thank you also for your heart and for spending time with both, by the way, not just the troops, but even the local nationals,
yes,
and the other contractors who were all international. There was a very international flavor where,
yes,
you were.
Very much so. And I got to lead two Sunnis to Christ. One got baptized in one of Saddam's swimming pools. Oh, yeah. I know it sounds crazy to say
awesome.
I had a blast in a combat zone, but I did, and I'd do it again.
Well, I saw folks' lives changed, and I'll never forget Specialist Johnson. Well, we'll stop there.
Okay.
Got to autograph this book before you go.
I'll do it, sir. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Take us to a freaking break.
Yeah. Get us some Kleenex, will you? Boomer,
yeah.
You're falling down on the job. So.
No, but I started to say, and I caught myself off guard by doing that. I remember Specialist Johnson, who accepted Christ on our FOB, got baptized, and died an IED strike a week later.
Yeah. I get it.
you can do ministry in a war zone.
Yes, you can.
Absolutely. All right, war protester chick. Love you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Phil Williams, Right Side Radio, solid conservative and just plain needing a Kleenex. We'll be right back.